From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit makes history as it gets the green light to enter bankruptcy.
I think any honest assessment would be, you know, a mix of relief and sadness.
And the green light to cut pensions of city retirees.
You know, we don't know at this point what the cuts are going to look like. And the judge did specifically say this is not a free-for-all in pension reduction.
How does today's ruling fit into Detroit's history?
To some extent, I'm encouraged by the lack of hysteria among Detroiters and among people in general. We thought we might see more screaming and yelling and posturing.
And we look at the politics of school lunches in Michigan. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On this historic day, Detroit, Michigan's largest city, is found eligible for Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection. Federal Judge Stephen Rhodes saying, "It is indeed a momentous day. We have here a judicial finding that this once proud and prosperous city is insolvent." And here's Kevin Orr, the city's emergency manager, shortly after Judge Rhodes' decision.
We are gratified with the court's ruling today regarding the city's eligibility to pursue a plan of adjustment under Chapter 9 of the Federal Bankruptcy Code. While we are very pleased, we remain very concerned about the need to adjust the city's debt, to improve its level of services for its citizens, and to also prepare for the city to exit this receivership in a fashion that restores democracy to the city.
So what does this all mean for Detroit, for our state? What happens next? This hour, we get answer to those questions as we're joined by Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst. And Eric Scorsone joins us for a look at the economic consequences of the nation's largest Chapter 9 bankruptcy ever. But first, we begin with Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter, Sarah Swick. She was in the courtroom this morning. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Cindy. Good to be here.
And joining Sarah is Stephen Henderson, the editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press. Thanks for joining us, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, take us inside, if you will, to Judge Rhodes' courtroom when things began at 10 this morning. How crowded was it?
It was fairly crowded. I was actually in the overflow media room, but there were a number of observers there, a lot of retirees. They're obviously interested in seeing what the outcome of this eligibility decision was, and a lot of them were not too happy with it.
And outside the building, I know protesters were there pretty early this morning. About how many were there?
Yeah, there was a group of protesters, I'd say maybe 50 or so, definitely not more than 100.
Were they chanting or were they just kind of making their presence known by standing there? What effect do you think they were hoping to have?
They were chanting, holding signs, sort of walking in circles in front of the courthouse and doing sort of soapbox speeches with a bullhorn and just generally, I think, trying to have their voices heard in some way. But they were expressing a lot of frustration that they weren't being heard at all.
And Sarah, it sure took a long time for Judge Rhodes to actually make the ruling official. I think more than 80 minutes for him to get there. Why do you think it took so much time?
My best guess is that he was being extremely thorough because he knows that this is going to be appealed. In fact, one of the city unions has already announced that they intend to appeal. And he wanted to, I think, just take it step by step, criteria by criteria, and say this is exactly why Detroit is eligible for Chapter 9 protection, and these are the objections. He laid out the objections as well and said, here's why I think they're wrong. So I think he was basically doing his homework for an appeals court.
Very, very methodical. Stephen Henderson, you have literally been pouring your heart out on the pages of the Free Press as this bankruptcy has unfolded. How did you feel as a Detroiter when you finally heard this become official and heard the judge rule that Detroit can enter bankruptcy?
Well, I mean, I think any honest assessment would be, you know, a mix of relief and sadness. You know, sadness that the city where I was born and where I've spent the majority of my life and where I'm raising my kids, you know, has reached such a low point. But relief that federal bankruptcy is a process that's set up to protect the city's interests in renegotiating huge unmanageable debt, and that there is a tremendous opportunity here for us to reset the table in a way that will make the city much better for my kids and maybe for their kids. So, I mean, I think anybody who is here has to be of two minds on this. Or two hearts, I should say.
Yeah, I'd say hearts, hearts and minds.
Yeah.
Stephen, the editorial in the Free Press that appeared online after Judge Rhodes' ruling, it calls for us to reject the false choice, that was the phrasing used, of art versus pensions or art versus police officers. And we certainly have heard union attorneys making that choice right from the get-go. Why is that a false choice?
You know, the DIA didn't cause the underfunding of the pensions any more than the pensioners caused the city to borrow too much money from banks. I mean, all of these things have been done sort of independently. And yes, there is a finite pool of money, or there will be, to be able to pay them all off. But I think we ought to avoid very facile but lazy us versus them kind of comparisons and choices. There are ways to solve all of these problems independently. The pensioners in particular, I think, have a very strong case that they should be made whole by the state of Michigan. There's a constitutional provision that says so. That has nothing to do with the DIA, which is our premier cultural asset, and as Rhodes said this morning, shouldn't be just tossed over lightly. If you're going to talk about monetizing that, you do have to talk about the value it holds for the city, its necessity to the city, and whether you're sort of plundering it for a short-term gain that doesn't really fix the problem. I mean, I think we have very quickly gotten to the point of everybody grabbing for what they think is on the table,
mm-hmm.
And turning on each other, which is not going to serve us very well.
Let's look at the now what part of this. Now that this ruling has come down, and there are so many movable parts to this. You've got the governor and state lawmakers, and Kevin Orr and Mayor-elect Duggan, new city council, unions, employees, pensioners, creditors, and I'd like to get your thoughts from both of you. Do you think that all of these movable parts can and will get on the same page of the hymn book and do what it takes to help as this bankruptcy is a fresh start for Detroit? Sarah?
I think to the degree that they're forced to by the bankruptcy process, I mean, I think Judge Rhodes has been pretty clear so far that he intends to move this case along expeditiously and that he wants to keep things as simple as possible. I mean, mediation is ongoing, but in terms of everyone getting on the same page, I mean, there's been no sign so far that the creditors are willing to make much of any concessions. I mean, obviously, when you're negotiating or bargaining, you sort of go in driving the hardest deal you can. Mm-hmm. So it remains to be seen if you know they'll sort of bargain down to maybe a mutual agreement. But it's just because there are so many moving parts, as you said, and as Judge Rhodes said, and so much complexity, it's hard to see everyone sort of getting on the same page.
You know, I think one of the things that's going to become very clear in bankruptcy is the amount of power that will be vested in Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, and in his plan. The Chapter 9 is designed specifically to prevent creditors from plundering municipalities the way they often do corporations in other chapters of the bankruptcy code. And his plan becomes essentially like the Bible. I mean, it's going to be very difficult for creditors to make the case, particularly if his plan treats all of them fairly, which is the standard that the court uses. It's going to make it almost impossible for them to argue for something else. And with Rhodes saying that he wants to keep this clean and somewhat tidy, that puts even more pressure on the creditors to accept what's on the table or cut deals that are even more favorable just to keep things moving along. I think that most of the cards at this point are in the city's hands, or more of the cards, I should say, than are in the creditors.
Stephen, you have had lengthy discussions with Mayor-elect Duggan. You and the Free Press editorial board reviewing all of the candidates for city council. So we've got some unknown new people on the city council. Will the city be in the right hands, in your view, once Kevin Orr moves up and out and is gone?
Well, I certainly hope so. I was pretty encouraged by the election results. I think we got the right candidate of the two choices in the mayor's office. Mike Duggan has a good record turn around. We'll see if he can apply that to a bigger job than he's ever had before and a different context than he's had to do it in. I also think we got pretty good results on the council race. I mean, six of the people that we chose to endorse ended up winning, so we think pretty highly of them, and that's a pretty strong majority if they can hang together and keep the sort of change-minded attitude that attracted us to them in the first place. I think we really could be in better shape. Of course, if you'd asked me 4 years ago mm-hmm. that same question, I would have said the same thing, and it didn't happen. So I'm a little cautious.
Your front page editorial, Stephen Henderson, in the Free Press, the headline read, "Make Lives Better." Bankruptcy or not, make lives better. Well, we have the bankruptcy to each of you. Sarah, do you think bankruptcy will help improve the lives of the people who are living in those neighborhoods in Detroit?
I think that eventually it will, but I think that, you know, bankruptcy or not, there was always going to be a really painful process to get there. It's just, you have to kind of feel for a lot of the pensioners, though, and, mm-hmm. and for the folks that are going to lose in this. And, you know, hopefully, as Stephen mentioned, that, you know, maybe the state or someone else will feel a responsibility to step in, but there's no indication that that'll happen. So, I do think that bankruptcy is a great opportunity for the city. But, again, like Stephen mentioned with Kevin Orr's plan of adjustment, I mean, that's when we'll really know sort of what the game plan is, what's going to happen, and how they envision restructuring the city's debts and how quickly that can sort of manifest as better quality of life for Detroiters.
And Stephen, will lives be made better?
I certainly hope so. I mean, we went waiting a long time, and I can't underestimate the number of false starts we've had. So my fingers are crossed, but, you know, as a good Detroiter, I'm always prepared for the worst and dedicated to weathering that, too, if that's what comes to pass.
Stephen Henderson, Detroit Free Press editorial page editor, and Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter. Thanks to both of you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, we'll stay in Detroit, and we'll welcome Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry to the conversation. He has been covering Detroit for decades and decades. We'll get his take on this historic day. That's coming up in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And so the proverbial other shoe has dropped. Detroit has now won the right to enter Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection and to cut the pensions of city retirees. So now what happens? We're joined by Eric Scorsone, a municipal finance expert from Michigan State University. Welcome back to Stateside, Eric.
Thank you.
Eric, did anything surprise you in Judge Rhodes' statement this morning?
Not too much. I think the biggest surprise was that he did rule on the pension issue. That was a little unexpected, but in general, I think it followed the script that we expected.
So what happens next?
So the next phase of the bankruptcy process is the plan of adjustment, which is where the city will lay out a plan of how it's going to cut different liabilities and expenditures to balance its books. And, you know, the creditors are in different classes, and each class will be treated differently, perhaps, you know, pensioners, current employees, bondholders, et cetera. And so, you know, the city will have some period of time now to sort of sort out and say, okay, here's our plan, judge. And the judge's role is to sort of rule and say, well, that looks like a good plan and fair to each group. And then, you know, that's how the process evolves from here.
So can you give us, Eric, a sense of what bankruptcy will actually look like and feel like? And I'd like to start with those who live in Detroit and call it home, and then we'll work our way out from there. So what does this mean for residents?
Well, I think for residents, probably not a whole lot initially. I think hopefully over time it means, you know, the judge, the term he used, which I thought was right on, is service delivery insolvency. So there's financial insolvency, and then there's the service insolvency, meaning services are not being provided to citizens. And by recognizing that, I think that's really critical, because he's saying we need to address that issue. We need to get the balanced book so the city can provide services. Now, that may take, you know, it's not going to happen overnight, but I think that will start to happen hopefully in the next, you know, year or two.
All right, let's move out. What about current city employees?
Well, you know, they're still going to get paid, of course, because they want them to come to work. I think the question of benefits, you know, is going to be an issue of what kind of benefits they're going to expect to see in the future in terms of health care, pensions, et cetera. Those may be adjusted to some extent. I think otherwise employees will, you know, probably not see huge changes. Some of those changes will occur outside of bankruptcy because the emergency manager in his role is going to be, you know, restructuring the city and so forth. So that's going to really occur outside of the bankruptcy process.
Do you think there would be potential layoffs, or do you think city employees, that's been cut to the bone, each department has already been cut to the bone?
I think to some extent that's certainly true. There is, you know, been a lot of reductions of you know, folks and empty positions eliminated. So I think it'll be hard to do a lot more layoffs. But I think, you know, there may be a few, who knows. I think though it'll be more of a question of reorganizing. How do you take the existing workforce and reorganize it to be more effective, more productive? I think that's probably the bigger question.
All right, let's wade in to the question of what bankruptcy could look and feel like if you are a city pensioner. And I'll start by saying I think it's really safe to say that the people who had the least to do with the city's money troubles are facing a really painful and scary future now that the judge has ruled that pension cuts are allowed in a federal bankruptcy case, even if those municipal pensions appear to be protected under the Michigan Constitution.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is really a shockwave ruling, not just Detroit, but really around the country. I think, you know, we don't know at this point what the cuts are going to look like. And the judge did specifically say this is not a free-for-all in pension reductions. You know, I'm going to look at this carefully. There's going to have to be a degree of equity about the cuts. So it certainly does not mean it's just open cutting, you know, for whatever you want. So I think we'll see what happens. But, yeah, I mean, obviously pensioners are going to be concerned. Also on the health care side, because actually the bigger problem is even the retiree health care. There will certainly be big adjustments to that as well, potentially.
But it does sound like the judge is cautioning Kevin Orr and his team, no slash and burn when it comes to city pensions.
Yeah, they're going to have a solid rationale for any reductions.
All right, let me take us off track a little bit and ask you this. Doesn't the state constitution contain an implied backstop? I mean, should there be a conversation about having the state set up a pension authority since it's the state constitution that protects these municipal pensions?
Yes, and I think this is where bankruptcy is really only a partial part of what's going on in municipal finance in Michigan, not just Detroit. We've got to rethink what we're doing here. The Constitution does essentially explicitly protect pensions. So the state government now is probably going to have to step up and say, what do we want to see here? You know, we know other pensions may have trouble. We know most cities have not funded their retiree health care.
Mm-hmm.
So really, we need to have a much bigger discussion about legacy costs beyond this bankruptcy, because this bankruptcy is only addressing a very small part of the bigger problem.
So we're really touching on something that we will likely hear a lot of conversation about in Lansing.
We should.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Eric Scorsone, who's a municipal finance expert from Michigan State University. We've had him on Stateside often explaining the ins and outs as we look at the municipal finances of cities in Michigan. And now let's talk about what the bankruptcy will feel like if you are one of the hundreds of creditors and bondholders to whom the city of Detroit owes money that it doesn't have.
Right. I mean, obviously, if you're a bondholder or something of that nature, you're going to see a reduction. But, you know, the question would be, you know, if you're a large fund, this is probably a very small part of your portfolio, so you'll see some losses. If you're, more of a vendor, you know, you may see some reductions.
Mm-hmm.
The city's going to have to be careful, of course, because it still wants to receive supplies and materials, and so it's going to have to do that strategically to make sure that, you know, still vendors are going to be willing to do business with the city. So those kind of changes are going to come to those groups as well.
Eric, what should we watch for in the weeks to come? And then taking a longer view, what should we watch for over the next year?
Yeah, I think in the short term, in the next 6 months or less, you know, we really want to see what is this plan? What is Detroit's plan to get out of the bankruptcy process and kind of have a clean balance sheet? Now, that's going to be the critical question. You know, and then the question, I think, more importantly, long term, is what is the governance of Detroit going to look like? What is the new mayor's role going to be? How soon is the emergency manager going to get out? And is there going to be some kind of transition advisory board? Because I think for all of us, we want to see a Detroit that's sustainable, you know, that this is the last time we have these kind of problems, hopefully. And that's a big challenge. And it's not, again, it goes beyond Detroit. We're going to have other cities like Flint, and now we have Lincoln Park, you know, that's been cited. You know, these other communities need to say, how do we get out of these situations in a more effective manner? You know, and I think that's the bigger story long term for all of us. That, you know, we don't have a lot more bankruptcies, hopefully.
And in fact, it seems you can't open up any paper in the state without seeing about another community that is got suddenly is under review.
Right. I mean, we're going to see more of these problems, unfortunately. And my prediction is over the next year or two, there will be more communities, especially in Southeast Michigan, under review, maybe under an emergency manager, certainly school districts as well. And so we're going to have to really think about the bigger public finance system and how it operates.
Eric, now that this bankruptcy medicine has been administered by Judge Rhodes and it's going forward, how long do you think it could take for Detroit to be on the way to becoming a viable municipality again?
I honestly think I'm a little optimistic right now. I do think in the next year, Detroit will kind of move through this bankruptcy process pretty efficiently, kind of like GM did, you know, against the odds. And I think it will be on better footing. Now, that said, we're going to have to make sure it stays there. And that's going to take a lot of still tough decisions by local elected officials, by the new mayor, and by the governor and others. So, you know, this is only the beginning of a process. But I am somewhat hopeful that actually Detroit, you know, the future does look a little better, I think, down the road.
Eric Scorsone, we thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Eric Scorsone is a municipal bankruptcy expert with Michigan State University. Let's take time now to put today's ruling by Judge Stephen Rhodes into some historic context. How does the painful journey into Chapter 9 bankruptcy fit into Detroit's past, present, and most importantly, its future? We're joined by someone who has covered the news in Michigan for some 5 decades, Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry. Welcome, Jack.
Good to be here.
Jack, what do you think Judge Rhodes' ruling means not only for the city of Detroit, but for the entire state of Michigan in historic terms?
Well, it's going to take a while to digest. He's got a 140-page memorandum, I think they're calling it, and I certainly haven't read or digested all of it yet. But as I said the other day, it may not be the beginning of the end of Detroit's troubles, but it's sort of the end of the beginning. It's clear now the bankruptcy will go forward. It looks like there's going to be pension cuts and sort of a lot of pain, but Detroit had to get there. This is hardly surprising to anybody, given the debt structure. One of the first things the judge said was that Detroit could no longer meet its obligations or meet the basic services it had to provide citizens. This has been building for a long, long time. It's not one mayor or two mayors. It's over at least 40 years. There's a lot of reasons why this happened, and the trick is for all of us, for everybody in state, to fix it so that we have a viable central city that is not a drag on the state's prosperity.
Do you think Chapter 9 will give Detroit that clean slate from which to rebuild, or I'm wondering, are expectations too high that this bankruptcy will be the medicine to cure Detroit's ills?
Well, it depends on what expectations are. You know, when General Motors and Chrysler went through bankruptcy proceedings 5 years ago, at the end of the day, when they emerged, they still had a sellable product. They had cars and trucks that they could sell that people wanted to buy. But it's not clear where Detroit will go at the end of the day of bankruptcy. When bankruptcy's over, the city may be shorn of its debts, or most of its debts, probably some of its assets as well, but it will still be a very, very poor city with tens of thousands of derelict buildings and a poor, poorly educated population. And how this city goes forward and becomes economically viable and even stays solvent, of course, it's not going to be allowed to borrow money anymore. It's certainly not going to be able to borrow money anymore. That is the, you know, $18 billion question.
Jack, you have covered the city for many decades, and I'm wondering, what have you
sort of
felt?
5 decades, what I think.
Five. Time flies, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, when you're not having fun.
What have you felt as all of this has unfolded, from the emergency manager and the city's filing bankruptcy and now today with the ruling? What has that felt like for you?
Well, I think, you know, this is not an overnight shock. I think looking at it. I think to some extent I'm encouraged by the lack of hysteria among Detroiters and among people in general. We thought we might see more screaming and yelling and posturing. There's really been sort of remarkably little of that. Most of the sort of naysayers on city council didn't run for re-election. We don't know enough about the new city council yet, but I think there is a universal feeling that this is very serious, that there's going to be pain, that something has to be done, whether people like it or not. There's going to be a lot here that nobody likes. But I think Detroiters, far more than 10 or certainly 20 years ago, are sort of facing up to the cold, bleak light of the aftermath of a lot of spending that wasn't backed up with realistic assumptions.
You know, Jack, it often feels as though the city of Detroit has become kind of a lab rat for municipal bankruptcy, for the entire world to dissect and examine and pass judgment and take photos of ruined buildings and empty fields. Do you think this Chapter 9 journey can give the city a new narrative?
Well, it is one more chapter in a continuing narrative. Detroit, even when times were good in Detroit, in the booming 40s and 50s, the world in which to which I was born, they said that when America caught cold, Detroit caught pneumonia. It was always sort of the canary in the coal mine because a car was the most easily postponed purchase. And when times started to get tough, people stopped buying cars and people would be laid off. Well, most cars aren't produced in Detroit anymore, or most cars aren't produced in America anymore. Even the cars that are bought in America are either produced elsewhere, a majority of them are made by foreign auto manufacturers. And the thing that, of course, people were most concerned about, the sort of underlying narrative, is a narrative of race. Detroit is a nearly all African-American city, well over 80% of the population, surrounded by the rest of the state being more than 90% white, whatever white means these days. But there's been surprisingly little racial recrimination. And of course, Detroiters, a majority, 55% of Detroiters, just elected a white mayor, and not all city council is African American anymore. And for the most part, people in the suburbs and outstate are not saying the kind of racially divisive things that were very common in the 70s and 80s. But this is always sort of in the background, and there is still some feeling among Detroiters that that white people built the city and sort of used it up and left it and left them sort of holding the bag. And just about everybody in Detroit believes there is some truth in that.
Looking at the whole state of Michigan, Jack, what do you think needs to happen to give everyone in Michigan an understanding that, in your words, as you put it in your commentary, they have a stake in the best possible outcome for Detroit?
Well, probably the easiest thing for people to see is that, you know, if Detroit is fixed, the state's bond rating is going to be better. That affects the economies and the investment possibilities of everybody in the state. And also it's going to be easier to attract businesses to Michigan, whether they come to Detroit or not. Even though Grand Rapids is doing very well, even though Holland, other parts of the state are doing very well, and we have all these flourishing resort areas, if you have a central city that is a national symbol of despair and destruction and dysfunction and crime, it casts a pall over the entire state of Michigan. And if that gets fixed, I mean, nobody thinks that Detroit is going to turn into Paris or Boston or Seattle in the next 5 years. But if the city can clearly seem to be sort of on the upswing, this will make a huge difference both psychologically and financially. But there are many problems other than the bankruptcy will deal with a crushing load of debt, even if it deals with it painfully. But there are lots of other problems, and the one problem that not only Detroit, but a lot of other places face, all of Michigan face, is that there are no longer going to be a state that has vast amounts of high-paying jobs for unskilled labor, brawn-based, muscle-based economy that's all over in the state. And people are going to have to be highly educated, they're going to have to be entrepreneurial, and nobody has really completely figured out how to do that in any place, including Ann Arbor.
Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry. As always, a pleasure. Thank you so much, Jack.
Pleasure to run my mouth with you.
Now let's take a quick listen to some of the voices surrounding this historic bankruptcy. Here's Detroit Mayor Dave Bing speaking shortly after the ruling.
It's a tough day for all of us here in Detroit. I believe since I came to office, with the crisis that we had, this was inevitable. I don't think anybody necessarily wanted to go in this direction, but now that we're here, it's more important that we work together as opposed to continuing to fight each other.
Meanwhile, Detroit Mayor-elect Mike Duggan issued a written statement saying, and I quote, "I'm going to do everything I can to advocate on behalf of Detroit's future in this process. We need to make sure the retirees are treated fairly on the pensions they earned. And we need to make certain we come out of bankruptcy in a way we can afford to provide the quality of city services the people of Detroit deserve." And here's the voice of one of the protesters outside the courthouse, Mike Mulholland.
That was disgusting. He essentially said to rich people and their foundations and churches, take pity on these poor people and make sure you save them a place at the soup kitchen. You know, I don't want to be a charity case. I worked. I worked my whole life. I worked since I was 16.
Just some of the voices following today's Chapter 9 bankruptcy decision. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, here's a question. Are schools in America flunking lunch? A 2007 school nutrition dietary assessment concluded most schools in America exceed USDA guidelines for the quantities of saturated fat, total fat, and sodium in the lunches we're giving our kids. And here's something else to chew on. The surplus beef and poultry that the USDA offers as free commodity items to our schools are held to a lower standard than fast food chains like McDonald's. In the past 10 years, the USDA paid $145 million for pet food grade spent hen meat that went into the school meals program. And yes, that does sound unappetizing. The average dollar amount spent per school lunch nationwide is just $1.25 of that is spent on milk. So what can school lunches tell us about the politics of welfare, food science, and agriculture companies? And what do they tell us about inequality in Michigan and through America? Joining us for the conversation is Susan Levine, who's a professor in the Department of History at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Her book's entitled School Lunch Politics, The Surprising History of America's Favorite Welfare Program. And Susan joins us from Chicago. Welcome to the program, Susan.
Thank you.
And Jean DuRussell Weston joins us. She's program manager for Project Healthy Schools at the University of Michigan. Hello, Jean.
Hello. How are you today?
Good to have you together to talk about a subject that really matters to so many homes. Susan, I want to start with you. In your book, School Lunch Politics, when you're looking at what you call the surprising history of America's favorite welfare program, what do you mean by calling it America's favorite welfare program?
Well, what I meant when I wrote the book was that the school lunch program, which began in 1946 as a kind of partly a subsidy for the American farmer and partly as a way to maintain healthy children, it became in the early 1970s essentially a really important welfare program for poor kids. It was and still is the largest nutrition program for poor for school-age children, and it's become a real poverty program or an anti-poverty program, you might say. But at the same time, it's the most, it's probably the most popular public program, maybe second only to, I would say, probably even more popular than Social Security in a way, because when you start attacking school lunch, people always get very up in arms, and you talk about the quality of the food the kids are eating or who gets to eat the food. There's a lot of passion to it.
There is, and I know in your work, Jean DuRussell Weston, here you are as program manager for Project Healthy Schools at the University of Michigan, and thinking about, we've got some 740,000 Michigan school kids that are eligible for free or reduced price lunch, and that's nearly half of our state's students. So what impact do you see on these children who rely on school lunches, for better or for worse?
Well, I think that some kids actually get breakfast and lunch at school, and so if we can make these school lunches as healthy as possible, we've already helped kids to have half of their day or three-quarters of their day be healthy choices. So we can have a great impact if the school lunch program becomes healthier.
Who decides, when we say if it becomes healthier, who decides exactly what winds up in cafeterias? Who decides the school lunch budget? Talk to us, if you can both, give us a sense of the economics of school lunches. Susan, I'll start with you.
Well, I think that it's a there's a very sort of complicated set of players. The federal government provides some cash subsidies depending on the number of poor kids in the school and a variety of other factors. It also provides, as you said earlier, some amount of surplus food as well. Local players have a major role, so state legislatures and state education representatives determine local subsidies. And then cities, towns, school districts also decide on their budget criteria in different ways. And so the school lunch is a sort of complicated arena, both of budget and of menu.
And Jean, your thoughts then. How does the decision get made, you know, as far as what will wind up on a plate in a cafeteria throughout schools in Michigan? Is there a great inequity between the districts?
Yes, there can be an inequity because depending on your district and what policy you may have, if you have a wellness committee and you have a policy that, you know, we're going to only have whole grain in our pizza, then your school district only has that. If you're in a poorer district that has to rely on basically whatever they're getting from the free and reduced lunch, then they're going to go with the most inexpensive food that they can find, which generally is not the healthy choice.
So give us examples of what's being fed to children in Michigan that, you know, in the lunches that really alarms you, concerns you.
Well, I think when we first came in, so we've been in operation for 10 years, and things have changed. And I want to thank Michelle Obama for Let's Move and her new push for the guidelines. So we have new guidelines coming out, and some of them are being, you know, enforced right now. But, you know, we would go in and you would see fried, lots of fried things, and most of them are getting away from that now. And we have baked French fries instead of fried, but lots of ranch dressing on everything. For breakfast, you could have a French toast stick as your choice for your grain instead of having, like, oatmeal. And there was nobody really enforcing what kids were choosing. And then a lot of places, the fruits were apples, and that might be the only choice. Hmm. And most kids are not going to take the time, or an orange, take the time to peel it. Or maybe they didn't even have a fruit choice. You know, it might have been a canned pineapple.
And probably in a lot of cases, the choices are, you know, what the kids are eating is also predicated on their school day. It could be such a compressed lunchtime that to get them through and out the door, that stuff gets thrown out. I remember seeing that when I was a lunchroom mom when my daughter was in grade school. I was astounded at how much went into the garbage can because they had to finish up and get out of the way so the next group could get
out. Yeah, that continues to be a huge problem because there's such a stress on academics. Mm. And now in Michigan, we have the new guidelines that, you know, kids have to pass these tests. And if they don't pass, their teachers get, you know, in trouble, basically. Yeah. So, you know, the academics is really taking precedence. So we push kids through lunch and give them a little bit of time to walk around, and then we try to, you know, get them right back in a classroom. And frankly, you know, people are missing the whole point that kids that are eating well and exercising are going to be brighter in the classroom and be able to learn better.
Susan Levine, many of us still vividly remember the ketchup as a vegetable from the Reagan administration days. Mm-hmm. Is that mindset because we are talking largely about feeding children who are underprivileged, or does this also come from pressure from big agribusiness?
Well, I think it's both. And I think that something that Jean just said is really important because the school lunch doesn't exist in a vacuum. So the context of the child's day, you know, and the stress on, as she said, on academics that compresses the lunchtime is one factor. The source of a lot of the food that we get in the school lunches is, you know, is kind of these huge food service corporations that contract with the local school district to deliver food. And the school districts that are the poorest, as Jean said, need to get the most economical, you know, deal that they can get, and it's not always the healthiest choice. So it's the agribusiness, the food service business, the education business, that they're all combined to put a lot of stress on the lunch.
So what kind of conversations should be happening both at the local level and the state level, and then I guess we'll even say nationally, to even out the inequalities in our school lunch program, Susan?
Well, I think that people have started a really important discussion about the quality of the food that's on the plate, and that's what we really talk about most. But I think what we also need to talk about is how we're paying for that food, and how the decisions are made about priorities in school budgets and in public budgets generally, so that if we talk about healthy schools, healthy children, it's not just a matter of one child picking, having, you know, access to an apple and another to, you know, whole grain. It's also a matter of the choices that the adults make in the community about what our priorities are. So I think those are the kinds of questions that have to surround discussions about school lunch.
And Jean DeRussell-Weston, with your work with Project Healthy Schools, how are you trying to get these discussions happening in Michigan cities and school districts?
One thing we do when we go into a school is we help them start a wellness committee. And that usually consists of having, you know, a teacher, the principal, parents, kids. And the wellness committee talks about the healthy environment that the kids are living in and how can they make additions and changes. So that gives a lot more group power to the people that are actually in that school to make some changes. So we will also work with food service and say, you know, okay, so we have a wellness committee here, a group that's saying, you know, we want different things on the ad hoc line, or, you know, they always have a line where kids can just go and get extra things. And usually it's all candy and, you know, sweets and things like that. And so then they can work together and say, okay, you know, why don't you offer something that, some granola bars instead of pastries? And then they work together within that school. And the best case scenario is that they have a district wellness committee, and then they have a policy which they will put out to all of their schools that says, you know, we can't have fundraisers that sell candy.
Hmm.
So that's what we try to do in the school, is empower them to make the decisions within.
Do the changes that should be made in lunches depend on money or changing a mindset? Susan?
Well, I think both. And I think we see now in the last, I'd say 5, maybe 10 at the most, years, a real change in mindset. And there is a really kind of growing food movement that is very conscious of what we're eating, and that brings that consciousness to the schools and to the school lunch. And there's a lot more attention to the quality of the food than I think you would have seen, you know, a while ago. But I think we also need to think about the other side as well. It's both of those things together that are crucial.
And certainly, Jean, you must encounter this constantly, working in the state of Michigan, where education funding is such a sore spot and such an issue, that finding money to change things is tough.
It's very tough. There's two things, I think. There's money, which is a big deal, and then also, you know, putting the spotlight on that problem, because a lot of schools have a lot of bigger problems.
Yeah.
So, you know, they do care about what they're feeding their kids, but they have a food service group that is a national chain. And so even to make some of these changes, they have to, you know, go up to their national piece. They can't just change it all of a sudden. So there is both of those things going on. And I think, you know, sometimes you can make some of these changes to a whole grain crust from a, you know, white flour, and it costs the same, but many times it doesn't. And so then there has to be that agreement within the group, well, okay, then we'll have to cut somewhere else in order to be able to do that.
But I think I hear from both of you that there is a challenge to parents to really get more informed and more active in this, because I guarantee most parents are not aware that, you know, this idea that the USDA paid all this many millions for pet food grade spent hen meat going into the school meals program. I don't think most parents would be very pleased. and don't know it.
Right. Although, I think more and more parents are aware of these things. It's just a question of how do you influence change. And I think part of it is that you try to do it on an individual level where kids and parents are making decisions about healthy food. But you also have to do it on a kind of collective level or a community level where the community says, schools are important, lunch is important, these things are real priorities. What we see now, in my opinion, is a moment when the public sphere is really being shrunk. And I don't know, you know, what's going on exactly, but people are making choices to cut the public sphere. So I think we're in a kind of contradictory moment in a way.
And how do you see it, Jean?
You know, I think individual level, I mean, you know, trying to work one child at a time to make a difference. I also think, though, that the policy level is really where we're going to get the permanent change. So we have to be doing both at the same time. We provide education in the classroom to kids so that they know how to make a healthy choice. And then that, we are hoping, is going to filter to their parents because we send things home and, you know, they're going to learn. At the same time, we're working with people like Healthy Kids, Healthy Michigan to get policies in place that say, you know, kids should have recess before lunch so that they are not being so, you know, they eat and then they run outside and then they don't eat well because they want to get outside. And also influencing, you know, what can be offered in the lunch line. And we're trying to do that at a state level. Of course, there's also the federal level. And that will determine this, you know, what you're saying, the grades of meat and food that we're offering at the federal level. Unless we change that, the schools are going to take that because that's, you know, that's part of the program. So we have to be doing all three levels.
That was Jean DuRussell Weston, who's program manager for Project Healthy Schools at the University of Michigan. And she was joined by Susan Levine, who's a professor at the Department of History at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Her book is entitled School Lunch Politics, The Surprising History of America's Favorite Welfare Program. It's been very good talking to both of you. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Good talking to you.
And we'd like to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the Detroit bankruptcy? What does this mean for the city's pensioners? Find us on Twitter and share your thoughts. We're at Stateside Radio. On Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and MichiganRadio.org. Click on the link that says Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Riley Linebaugh, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.